We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnava.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Don comes here with a 38-year medallion in his pocket. He and his wife, Joan, had the same exact sobriety date, November 10th, 1975. And we're so pleased to have had both of them tell their stories this month. And Don, I guess it's your turn to tell it how it really was for you.
Thank you. My name is Don Millar, is the last name, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I'm particularly grateful that Bobby is here. When we went to move north to North Georgia, he was somebody we met early in the program, and he used to have a great saying that I've always appreciated, and that is, I had some hard times, and some of them were real. Okay, first of all, I would like, if you don't mind, I've been freaking out about this all week since Joan told her story, and I'd just like to go to God in prayer, the God of my understanding, and if you would just bear with me. Heavenly Father, I don't want anybody who needs to hear something that I've got to say to not hear it from me. And at the same time, Lord, I need to keep it within 45 minutes. So please be with me and help me, for I ask it all in your holy name. Amen. Okay, I had absolutely no excuse for being an alcoholic. I grew up with very godly parents in a godly home, and they, but I rejected that. I'll get to that at some point. But, and they got me off on the right foot. I remember when I was in the eighth grade, that one, I think it was a Monday. It must have been a Monday because I'd heard a very evangelical sermon the previous night. And so I laid my head down on the desk and said, Lord Jesus, please accept me. I want to be your child. And he did. And the thing about it is that I did all my sinning after that. So Joan tells me I need to do this. I take an asthma med, two of them actually, that make it, they mess up my vocal cords. So if you can't hear, hold up a hand, please. Okay, so I grew up in this godly family, and my grandparents on one side were Scottish, and on the other side, English. And they were part of a great migration of skilled tradesmen that came near the turn of the century, this past, you know, the 2000. And none of them drank. I never saw anybody in my family drinking. Now, my English grandfather, it is true, had a father who's my great-grandfather, and he was a notorious alcoholic in Farnborough, Hampshire. And but late in life, he had some kind of spiritual awakening and died sober, completely sober. And on the other side, the Scottish folk, they obviously knew something I didn't know, because for five generations, they were teetotalers. And so they obviously, there was something back there that provoked that teetotaling thing, because the Scots liked to drink. And we used to go up there when we lived in England and do a lot of drinking with them. But anyway, this is the way it was. Now, I want to say one thing about Joan's presentation last week. And this is not a rebuttal, because she said nothing that I feel like I need to rebut. I agreed with every bit of it. And she told you about her roots. She had all people back to the Mayflower and, you know, all the wars that this country's ever fought in and all of that, the Confederacy, everything else. But my people, you see, were immigrants. And so it got to a point where I sort of discounted them, as I figured they didn't really know the way you live as an aristocratic Virginian. Now, we grew up in Virginia. I didn't have anything to do with the Virginia aristocracy. But I thought I knew something about it. So we went to a party when I was in medical school. I worked, Joan and I had just been married. We went to this party. I worked as an extern in a hospital in Richmond. And the guy who owned the hospital was First Families of Virginia. He had a plantation up on the James River. He had a beautiful, luxurious home in the city. And he invited us, because I was an extern at his hospital, to come to his Christmas party. And I got there, and it really affected my life, because in this Christmas party, he had liveried servants. These were people who were in the proper dress for being entertaining and all of that. He had pheasant on the glass, Smithfield ham, turkey, anything you can imagine. And he had anything you can imagine to drink. And I said to myself, no, these are the people who know how to live. My parents, they got it all wrong. If you're going to be successful and if you're going to do something worthwhile with your life, you got to get like this and not like my folks. So I sort of gave up on them. I thought their religion was overly simplified, and that they didn't have it right. They were immigrants, after all. And by that time, you know, I was feeling a little pride and thinking I knew more than they did. So anyway, but the thing I want to leave with you above all is that God had his hand, the God of my understanding, had his hand on my life throughout. And I'll be 80 my next birthday, which is in February. And one of the things that comes from living long is you get a chance to look back over your life, and you can see the crucial times when a God of your understanding was operative in your life. And I've got lots of those to look back on. For instance, just to give you a few examples, when I was with the how I got to the Centers for Disease Control and the Epidemic Intelligence Service and all of that is a miracle in itself, but I'm not going to bore you with that. I'll simply say this. I came to the great CDC to do 2 years of military obligation, and I ended up retiring from there 32 years later. And God had his hand in all of that. They kept sending me stuff that I couldn't resist. Like, for instance, in the first 2 years when I was doing my military obligation, I had been around the world twice. And on the way back from one of those trips, I flew from, I think it was somewhere in India, or maybe it was Saigon, I'm not sure exactly. But I was flying to Jakarta, Indonesia. And on the way down there, we hit some kind of thing. And we dropped several hundred, if not thousand, feet in the air. And they were in the process of serving supper, and dishes were flying everywhere. And I told Joan when I got home, I said, I was afraid at that moment that you wouldn't even have a body to bury, that I'd be in the whatever that ocean is out there between Saigon and Jakarta. But that didn't happen. The guy recovered the plane, and we went on, completed the journey, and I did my business down there and came home. Lived to tell about it. And then when I was in West Africa directing the smallpox eradication program over there, on six different occasions, I was put under house arrest in Africa because of coups they were having at that moment in that particular country. And none of those things ever resulted in any, there was danger, plenty of danger, but nothing hazardous happened to me in the process of all that. And then the Biafra War, I don't know whether you remember, Biafra was a part of Nigeria that seceded and started a war. So very much modeled the kind of thing like happened with us in our Confederacy. And they lost. But in that process, I was in the Biafran combat zone on several occasions. And again, nothing happened to me. And then finally, I'm just getting started good. But I flew into Athens one time from Africa, and I was traveling with this English guy, and we had been out there for several weeks. And this coup in Athens was inspired by an attempted communist takeover. And it was not successful. The reigning regime resisted it. But anyway, in this coup in Greece that I flew into, totally unexpected, they told us, and I was with this English guy. I don't know what happened to the Russians, incidentally. I mean, I never heard. Did these guys escape? Because there were Russians on a plane, too. But they said to me, okay, you're going out here to a nice resort on the Aegean Sea, but if you leave the premises, you will be shot. So, I mean, we didn't leave the premises, I can tell you that right now. But anyway, these are all things that happened to me, and I've just got a great deal of gratitude to God, because a lot of this stuff could have been potentially very dangerous, and it was not. Now, when did we become alcoholics? Well, I think you heard Joan comment on this last week that I spent a year at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in London. When was that? 65, 66. And while we were over there, this is where I think we crossed the line, because in England, for one thing, this school I was going to, they had one exam at the end of the year. So we had the entire year to play. And we went to the pub every night, drank until they closed the pubs, which, you know, there was 11:30, 12 o'clock. And you could always leave the pub with a big jug of something, ale or whatever you wanted to take home with you. I mean, this was no problem. And so I really consider that that's where the cross over the line happened. I'd had a lot of experiences in West Africa, and one of them in West Africa was very interesting, that I went out there with my boss, and I'll mention him again soon. We were out there for 21 days, and it was the other way around, 19 days we were out there. And during that time, we went to 22 cocktail parties. So, you know, that's more than one a day in some situation. And so he knew I was a serious drinker. But anyway, I think this turnover came about this time in England. Well, when we got back from England, I was put in charge of domestic programs at CDC. And, well, no, it was the African program came after that. But anyway, after the African thing was over, and I got back and was sort of purely domestic, I had this opportunity to go to Yellowknife. Anybody in here been to Yellowknife, Canada? Okay, I was up there in Yellowknife attending this thing. It was a circumpolar health meeting, and it was at Yellowknife. And I saw something there that really stuck with me. This guy came in at some point in the evening. He was obviously a trapper or something. He came in and he brought with him an outboard motor. And he put the outboard motor up on the bar there, and he said, "Let me drink until I've drunk this up." And I watched the guy, and he went back to his table and was very well behaved, but he kept drinking as long as they were willing to finance it. And I just thought, you know, now, here's a guy with an outboard motor. It's a priceless thing in his setting, but he's willing to give up all of that to drink. Okay, what happened? Well, what happened, I'll give you, again, a series of things that strike me as more or less miraculous. In 1975, early in the year, I went to India. I was invited over there by one of my bosses, and I think he understood this guy needs to be broken from his alcoholic behavior. So he brought me over to India, and in India, I was in Bihar State, any of you who may know where that is, and you couldn't get any booze over there. It just wasn't available. I mean, the Indians at that time didn't drink, at least not in Bihar. And so no alcohol was available. And I was over there several weeks, and during all of that time, I drank nothing. And boy, I came out of there saying, man, you got this thing whipped. And all you have to do is just keep doing what you're doing, and everything's going to be fine. Well, I got home, and on the 27th of February, which is my birthday, some friends came over, and they brought one bottle of wine. I think Joan told about this last week, too, didn't you? But anyway, before the evening was over, we drank up everything that we had in the house, which was plenty. And also, we collected lees to make brandy with wine. We made our own wine and then collected the lees and wanted to distill them into brandy. And we even had some of that stuff, which is very unappetizing. And we had that in the basement. We even drank that. And so I knew after that, after the birthday drunk, that, you know, I was in trouble. I was an alcoholic. There wasn't any question in my mind about it at that point. Okay, but I still wasn't ready to quit. And what happened next, I was called on to go speak up in my hometown, Norfolk. Well, I grew up in Newport News across the Hampton Roads, but Norfolk. And they had a big meeting there, and I was going to go, and I was going to be a featured speaker and all of that. And it had nothing to do with alcoholism, I can tell you that right now. It was a, you know, public health meeting. But anyway, I sobered up 2 or 3 days in advance so that I'd be in good shape to give the speech and not embarrass myself. And I went up there to Norfolk, and incidentally, I spent some of my time teaching them how you say that. It ain't Norfolk, it's Norfolk. And so I taught all these people from all over the country, you know, that's how you do it. Well, that night, they had a cocktail party, and I went to it. I'd done my duty. I was now free to drink. And I started drinking, and the next night they had another cocktail party, and I went to that one. And there again, this guy walked up to me and he said, "Listen, I really do appreciate what you did for me last night. That commitment you made to me is very important." Well, I was totally amnesic. I didn't know the guy, the event. And so I came home from there saying, "Look, so far you've protected your career, but if this keeps up, you won't have any protection for that career. They're going to get rid of your rear end, and it won't be long." So I came home from that, and it was not long after that that Joan, she always takes the lead in all this stuff. She called this friend that we had known, and we had seen him. He'd been in the program 6 years. We saw him at a shrink's office. We went in there dealing with a hangover or something. But anyway, he was there. And he said, "Look, I've come to understand that my problem was alcohol. And so now I'm going to AA, been 6 years at it, and it's been very successful. And so if you ever think alcohol is your problem, give me a holler." And that was Ross Wilson. And he happened to be in there seeing the shrink because he lost his only daughter in an accident out in, where was it? Idaho. Well, yeah, it was on the Snake River in Idaho. And he and his wife were both in there, but he told us, you know, my problem is alcohol, not that I need therapy. And I couldn't believe, here's a guy who lost his only daughter in a tragic accident. They still hadn't recovered her body, and yet he was this serene. I just couldn't imagine it. So anyway, Joan soon thereafter called Ross, lined us up to go to our first meeting, and you heard her tell about how she was thought we were too valuable to do it in our neighborhood, so we had to go all the way down to Buckhead, and we went to the Triangle Club down there, and Joan picked up her white chip. She leapt up and picked it up. And And then I got up 20 seconds later and picked up my white chip. And on the way home, I told her, I said, look, I'm the alcoholic in the family. What is this? You're horning in on my deal. And we were kind of like that in those days. We didn't mind teeing off on each other. But it wasn't. I have never regretted picking up the white chip. And thank God we've never had to pick up another one. You know, it's one shot. And the reason I think this is the way it is, I see a lot of young people coming into AA these days, mandated by the courts and what have you. And the thing that there was no way I would have been ready to pick up a white chip at the age of a lot of people that are now coming into the program. Now, I would, if you're one of those people, for goodness sakes, pick up the white chip, get on with it, because it's really going to bless your life over the long haul. But we were 42 at the time, and we had hit our bottom. I mean, there was nowhere else for us to go except AA, and I just thank the God of my understanding all the time that He did that for us, got us here. And we didn't, you know, this is another thing that's miraculous to me. We never killed anybody on the highway. We never got anybody in our family killed, although we had DUIs and did a lot of drinking and a lot of coming home late and should have had DUIs on many occasions. I've got one of them in my office at home, mounted on the wall to remind me that this is one you had and you didn't get away with. But anyway, came into AA, and NABA became very important to me at that point, because people told us to do 90 meetings in 90 days, and I had a sympathetic boss, and he knew I needed to do something about my drinking. So he told me, when I approached him, I said, look, I'm going to be going over to NABA Club. They got an 11 o'clock meeting over there, and I'm going to be going. That's where I'm going to be spending my lunch for some time. And he was, very supportive. So I did that, and I came over here and came to these meetings, and frequently we'd come back again the night. Joan was the person who first started the non-smokers meeting, which met right back there in that room. And it just worked. You know, it worked. That's all I can say. So here we are, long time later, and looking back on this, and you can see God had his hand on all of it, every bit of it. So I wondered, what am I going to do with all this spare time I've got now? I used to be drinking every night, and a lot of times, 5 o'clock, I had this thing saying, if the sun is over the yard arm, then you can drink. Well, as somebody pointed out to me, hey, the sun is over the yard arm somewhere all over the world, so you drink anytime. Well, I didn't do that because I was really interested in not losing my career. But one of the things that came because of spending so much time in AA meetings, in addition to sobriety, was that I had an opportunity to learn string bass, and had all this extra time. And I had some friends in the Atlanta Symphony who knew somebody who was a great bass player, and he was willing to teach me. He got a huge kick out of the fact that at that time I was the boss of the venereal disease control program. And he said, oh, yeah, well, we're going to, this guy. And so I spent 2 years with Tom Thorson, and then he said to me, look, you're ready. Go try out for the, it wasn't a tryout. It required no audition to play with the DeKalb Symphony. So I went over there and started playing with them and have continued to play in musical organizations. I play in the Toccoa Symphony up in North Georgia. I play in my church orchestra. And incidentally, I teach a Sunday school class at Cleveland First Baptist Church. Any of you who happen to be up that way and you want to come to my Sunday school class, I'll tell you, there's a lot of AA talked in that Sunday school class. But anyway, so I just want to conclude by observing this. AA saved everything that was important to me. It saved my marriage. Joan and I had a troubled relationship. You can imagine, I mean, how alcoholics are and the kind of stuff you get into. And she talked about some of that last week. And I remember I went over to Geneva one time. This was before we quit drinking. And I met with a friend, and I said, Joan and I are separated. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I'm afraid it's over. This guy looked at me, he had taught me at the London School, and he said, you are out of your mind. You don't know what you're doing. I know Joan, and I know she's perfect for you. And I came home stunned from that trip to Geneva, and just that ringing in my ear, you don't know what you're doing. And he was absolutely right. So AA saved the marriage, saved our family, and I just recently came into the understanding that it also saved me my relationship with my one brother. I used to resent him. I mean, he had all the athletic ability in the family. He was an all-star football player. He had good eyes. He was able to qualify for the Navy flight program and spent the rest of his career as a pilot with Northwest Orient Airlines. He went in there right after Nixon opened China. He went in there right after that as an airline pilot, Northwest Orient. And so, and it saved that. I've just come to understand that recently, because all that resentment that I had against him for all these things, I thought my parents preferred him to me and all that has disappeared. It's not part of the picture anymore. Now, I just want to conclude with this. When we decided to move to North Georgia because our son had decided he wanted to live up there, he'd gone to school at Young Harris, fell in love with the mountains, and so he wanted to go up there. Well, I said to Joan, I assume we're going back to Virginia. That's where we're from. She said, you can go wherever you want, but I'm telling you one thing. I'm going to North Georgia and live next to my son. And it didn't take long for me to get that picture straight either. So anyway, let me just quickly read this to you. This turned out to be a devotion that we did this morning, and I just thought it was wonderful. November 18th, and what? Speak? Okay, all right. See, asthma stuff, man. Wait patiently, trust humbly, depend only upon, seek solely to a God of light and love, of mercy and goodness, of glory and majesty, ever dwelling in the inmost depth and spirit of your soul. There you have all the hidden, invisible upholder of creation. whose blessed operation will always be found by a humble, faithful, loving, calm, patient introversion of your heart to Him, who has hidden heaven within you, which will open itself to you as soon as your heart is left wholly in His eternal, ever-speaking Word and ever-sanctifying Spirit within you. Beware of all eagerness and activity of your own natural spirit and temper. Run not in any hasty ways of your own. Be patient under the sense of your own vanity and weakness, and patiently wait for God to do His own work and in His own way. Now, last week, Joan sang a song for you. I'm not going to do that because my voice is not as good as hers. But what she didn't include in that song is this piece of the lyrics. He's all we need for every need. We need never be alone. Still, He'll let us go if we choose to live life on our own. Then the only good that will ever be said of the pains we find ourselves in is there are places to gain the wisdom to say, I'll never leave you again. Thank you.
I'd like to say thank you at the outset for allowing us to do this. This has really been a great blessing, our reunion with NABBA Club. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. That was wonderful.
In the basement of the church around the corner, quietly I found myself a seat and held on to my little cup of coffee, utterly admitting my defeat. They talked about some steps and some traditions and some promises I didn't understand. Feeling out of place, I walked toward the back door. Then I heard the gentle voice of some old man. We're glad you're here, 'cause we've been there. And it's hard to find someone who understands and loves to care, put down your pain, cast out your fears. We've all been there, and we're glad you're here. I walked back in and sat right down beside him. Listened as someone poured out a heart. Thought about my past and my condition, all the years of living in the dark. She talked about her fears and her confusion. I listened as the tears rolled down her face. I realized I felt what she was feeling. When she finished, I heard someone say, we're glad you're here, 'cause we've been there. And it's hard to find someone who understands enough to care, put down your pain, cast out your fears. We've all been there, and we're glad you're here. we've all been there, and we're glad you're here. We're glad you're here, 'cause we've been there.